Hello, I'm Julian Morrow. Thanks for joining me. In just a moment, we've got more from the Best of Background Briefing in 2021. And later this hour, we'll meet the unconventional researcher who Tim Flannery describes as a hero of biology who deserves the highest honours that science can bestow. His name's Joel Berger, and we'll find out why he wears a polar bear suit to work. Over summer, we're bringing you some of the highlights of Background Briefing in 2021. And today, it's a Walkley Award-winning investigation into a hidden corner of our biggest city. A small patch of land where people on low incomes have found a place that they can call home amid a house price boom. And a warning before we start, this episode contains some strong language and a description of domestic violence. Here's Background Briefing host, Alice Brennan.
House prices in Sydney are going up by $1,000 a day. It's eye-watering. If we weren't in the middle of a housing crisis before the pandemic, we certainly are now. Where are the housing options for people who need to live in our cities for work or for their kids' education or for family, but they aren't paid enough to keep up? And what about the people who, even when they do find affordable housing in our cities, struggled to get a lease because they're in and out of work or they have bad records? Where do they go? ABC reporter and photojournalist Mridula Amin found one place in Sydney where people in that position are clinging onto a small patch of land that they can call home. Mridula, tell us about the place.
Yeah, so it's a caravan park in Western Sydney and it's called Fairfield West Caravan Park. It's one of the last affordable parks that are left really close to the city that people can actually stay in long term. And when I started trying to find it, it was actually surprisingly hard. It's on a major suburban street, but it's hidden from your eyeline by a really big wall. On that street, it's called Paulding Street. There's a really busy 7-Eleven station that's always buzzing. But if you go down this slither of a driveway right next to it, it eventually opens out into this incredibly quiet, peaceful caravan park.
So, Mridula, you ended up meeting a few of these people, yeah? The people who actually live in this park.
Yeah, so I've spent a lot of time there over the last couple of months learning about the lives of the people who live there, their routines, their secret hopes and fears.
And so that's what we're going to hear today. The stories of the people who live in this place, the Fairfield West Caravan Park. And I do want to say at the outset of this show, it's not about all the policy failures that have led to this point in our cities or how we could solve these problems. We just want to share some stories that we don't hear very often. The stories of people who are trying to carve out a space for themselves in one of the least affordable places in this country.
And I should really thank the people there at the outset for trusting me so much with their stories. They've taught me a lot. The people in this park, they're holding on to the hope that in this city where land now seems to be more precious than gold, there's still some place for them to exist. And they're scared that even this park of last resort might one day disappear.
Okay, Mridula, take us there. Describe this place for us.
Okay, so imagine a white sort of demountable portable home. It's a Sunday morning.
What are you drawing? Tell me what you're drawing.
Godzilla.
Oh my god, that looks amazing.
What's that?
That's a building.
And what's Godzilla doing?
He's sonic breath into the building.
Is he going to set the what on fire?
Yes.
I'm sitting at a kitchen table, watching a loving mother and her six-year-old son draw a monster destroying a town.
Is Godzilla destroying the town because that's what he doesn't like, towns?
The light's gentle, moving through black sheer curtains to hit the paper and pencils. The tea towels by the sink are neatly folded. The drawings on the fridge are all perfectly spaced. In the next room, words cut from wood perch on the sideboard. They say things like family, hope, and love. It's warm in here. But as I step outside, I find a starkly different world. Rows of big white boxes line each side of a tiny empty street. Some fronted with flowers, guarded by chipped garden gnomes. Some are bedazzled with fairy lights. Others are adorned with just a garbage bag or a disused mattress. At night, it's strangely silent.
And occasionally someone's light sort of goes on, but if that didn't happen, I'd just feel like basically everyone's on vacation, despite the fact that I know that 120 people are living behind these closed doors.
Mostly contractors, shift workers and pensioners live here. A lot of them are divorced men.
And sometimes you see the faint outline of someone kind of walk past a window or a light go on or off. But apart from that, there's just nothing.
I'm standing next to a strip of newer caravans that some residents like to call the North Shore. Living in a caravan park was never what most of the people here aspired to. It was meant to be something temporary, just a month or two. But years down the track, they haven't left. This place is cheap, but it's not the cheapest in Sydney. Part of what keeps people here is the difficulty of getting a private rental with a patchy history, or the fear of committing to a fixed-term lease when work is precarious. When all that seems impossible, this place, a place that started out as a last resort, becomes home.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon? What are you talking about? It's the morning.
Morning. It's only 11 o'clock, isn't it? Say good morning to David and Phil Michael, please.
Hi. Radula. We've met before.
David Michael, this is Matula. What do you want now? Tell me.
Andrew's sitting in the sun with some of his mates in the caravan park. He's a 68-year-old pensioner who's been living on his own in the park for the last 7 years. And he's the first person I really got to know here.
Like, tell me how the game was.
You didn't come. You missed out. It's not my fault.
This is normally what happens when I fob off going to the football with him.
Can't you tell how the game was? I can't even speak. Let me hold you. I'm going to get up, will you? Hold on. I'm sore, man. 9 hours I was there. Let's go. Come on.
These days, Andrew's a big fella with black-rimmed Coke bottle glasses, making his big friendly eyes look really small.
You missed out last night.
But I've seen photos of him as a handsome and strapping young soccer player.
I don't like soccer, Andrew. I don't like soccer.
Why? You have to like soccer. Because
why
I told you to come, now that's why I'm pissed off with you.
You're really disappointed that I didn't come?
Yeah, because I wanted you to see what things are like.
Are you going to go to the game tomorrow?
It depends on weather permitting. I don't know. Don't forget I've got to work and I'm still tired from yesterday, man. Yeah, it's bullshit, eh?
Yeah, they've been quiet, but today's the first day. Watch out, the truck's coming back.
In a minute.
Bastard.
No, you're right. I should be up to go.
I didn't make it to the soccer match with Andrew, but he did agree to meet up with me in the morning.
Morning, Darren. Hey, mate.
Andrew's driving a truck winding through a concrete warehouse complex in South Granville in Western Sydney. He's sitting next to his mate, Bob.
Oh, yes, you can.
He's about to make some money.
Watch that van next to you. Watch that guy.
I'm going to stop here, Bob.
Yeah, that'll do.
Let me just let the girl go back up and eat, Bob.
With its wiry cage, the truck looks a bit like a chicken coop on wheels. We arrive at the treasure. 20 broken washing machines discarded by nearby factories. Andrew lifts the machines with his bare hands up onto the truck. He's going to sell the metal and the machines for cash. He's been doing this for 20 years.
Copper's the most expensive non-ferrous metal, $7 a kilo. $7 a kilo. And that's 10, 5 cents a kilo.
It's back-breaking work for a young person, let alone someone who's pushing 70.
Just take a fiver, Andrew.
Okay, man. My heart's going like that, you know? And I'm old, man, I'm old. I'm working like a 20-year-old, I'm 68, 69, you know what I mean? It's too much, but I enjoy it most times.
I ask him why he's still busting his guts doing this kind of work.
Now, if you're paying $600 a fortnight rent, that leaves you $300 a fortnight to live on. I don't think anybody can live on $300 a fortnight, especially if you've got a vehicle and petrol and stuff like that, and other bills that come with it.
I can't shake the feeling that something's not quite adding up, and there's something else driving him to do all this.
What, do you see what I've done? Oh, you haven't seen what I've done, have you? You wouldn't do this, would you? Matula, could you do my job or not? You couldn't do it in a million years. And I'm 69. Get down. But I love it. And when the gown gets tough, the tough get gown, baby. That's all. Get it?
Andrew's put in on a brave face. He's tired. But he does tell me to come see him on the weekend.
I'll see you guys later. I'll see you on Sunday, yeah? Andrew?
It's early in the park, and Andrew doesn't seem to be home.
I'll just try and knock on his door again. I have this feeling that he might be in there. Andrew? Hello?
When Andrew eventually emerges, it started to rain, so we sit down inside. Today he's in a more reflective mood and up for a chat.
In the last 7 years, 8 years, I've been here, 7 years. The last 7 years I've been here. But I'm happy and I'm not happy here because it's good, yes and no. It's got good things, it's bad things. There's a lot of inquisitive people who know what your business, who know what you're doing. And some of you are going to have privacy, number one. Second, I wasn't happy with the caretakers because the previous people, there's the mother lawns, they were spotless, mate. They had chairs, they had TVs in every place, you know what I mean? And now they've let it run down.
For Andrew, Fairfield West was the park of last resort when life tripped him up. He was once a successful businessman travelling the world.
I took my wife overseas to Europe and Greece and Cyprus because she was born in Cyprus, my wife. I met her here in Australia. We spent 9 weeks in Europe, Greece and Cyprus, and it cost us $40,000 in 1982. That trip, 1982 trip, was the best time of my life, full stop.
When his wife ended the marriage, Andrew left the house to her and their boys. Then the global financial crisis hit. The scrap metal price collapsed and his once lucrative business failed. He found love again with Susie, who shared his passion for football, but she died of breast cancer in 2010.
Yeah, I don't want to say too much because it hurts, man. She suffered from breast cancer for a lot of years and then I don't want to talk about it. I'll start crying. I don't want to do that, man. All right? I went to the pinnacle and then something dragged me down to the gutter, not the gutter, but very low. And I was of low self-esteem. I was saying to myself, why God take me, don't take her, you know? She was a lot younger than me. And to this day, I still think about her and I'll always think about her.
Andrew moved into the park in 2013. His rent is $320 a week plus $25 for power. So that's $345 a week to live here. With the age pension and rent assistance paying Andrew about $465 a week, he's got about $150 to live on. Maybe enough to just scrape by without working. So it kind of makes me wonder, why is he still selling scrap metal?
So now's the time, the most important time for a parent to look after their child or children when they're young. They need the help. They need the help.
Andrew reveals to me that he has a young son. Ben is just 11 years old. Andrew had him with Susie before breast cancer took her life. Now Ben lives with Susie's sisters and Andrew pays maintenance money for his care.
Do you still see Ben?
Twice a week. Because I might go this afternoon and pick him up, go somewhere.
Why doesn't he live here with you?
Well, I work and he goes to school. He's only 11 going to 12. It's a bit hard, you know.
The dream Andrew's working so hard towards is living with Ben. He wants them both to move in with his other son.
My older son's getting the house and I'm going to live in a granny flat with my other boy, Ben. That's my dream and that's, I think it'll become reality. It just takes time. You've got to be patient, that's all. And that's my dream. And my dream will come true.
It's that dream driving Andrew. And he needs Fairfield West Caravan Park to help keep it and him alive.
I feel like the whole world left on my head. But I've come out of it the other side just, and I'm surviving. I'm a survivor.
How are you guys?
Good. What are you doing?
We're doing a bit of a story for the ABC around this caravan park. We're talking up a few of the people, like Andrew and Jen and Anthony, if you know them. You guys know everyone at the park?
We've got JJ's number.
What's JJ? Every time I come to this park, someone will give me a number for someone else.
My producer Jeff and I struck up a conversation with one of the people we've run into.
I live on my own. I have two cats. My babies. Yeah.
How long have you lived here for?
14 years. A long time.
This is Madrula, and I'm Jeff, and what's your name?
Cheryl.
Do you mind?
Nice to meet you.
Do you mind if we come and have a chat to you sometime?
No, I don't mind.
Okay. Yeah.
Maybe we'll get your number down just in case, give you a heads up.
The caravan park's on a hill, so you could look out right now and just feel like you're in any sort of caravan park on the coast. I can't even see the road. The only reason that I can even qualify that I'm here is because you can still hear the sound of traffic going past. But otherwise, the way it looks, it's just this kind of dead quiet caravan park looking up at the stars.
As I come up to Cheryl's place, I see her cat, Coco. Hey, Coco. It's Mridula from the ABC. The ABC.
ABC.
How are you going?
I'm going good, and yourself?
Good. Do you want me to take my shoes off?
No.
Oh, good. It's kind of good that you have these concrete floors. In the end, you know. Inside Cheryl's van, there's never any sense of time. It's always really dark. Whenever I walk in, Cheryl draws the blinds behind me really quickly, whether it's day or night. As we sit on her couch, sipping packet cappuccinos, smoke wafts around her short grey hair. The TV screen illuminates the rental listings, cat food and medications that cover her coffee table.
She's gonna say hello.
Cheryl always speaks to her two cats like a doting mother. Her big blue eyes become loving and her weathered face crumples into a kiss.
Hello. Hello, baby. What you doing?
Cheryl's suspicious that the park's gonna be sold.
Well, you know what? It's. I see well-dressed men in here all the time walking up and down the street with folders in their hands, and they're, like, talking about putting flats here. Yeah, that's what I got told.
Cheryl's looking to get out of the park. She's inspected a lot of rental properties in the last few months. How many would you say, if you were going to guess?
I would say about 50, 60 properties we've seen so far.
Cheryl moved in on Christmas Eve 14 years ago, put up her blinds, and that was that. She has a few friends in the park, but largely keeps to herself, like pretty much everyone else here.
If I'm going past, I'll say hello and have a chin wag, but other than that, I just go collect my bottles and come home.
She's cagey about why she suddenly moved here all those years ago. Cheryl's been on a disability payment since she was a teenager, so it wasn't a financial issue. But slowly, she starts to open up.
Now, I wanted to get married, have a family and lived in a little cottage with picket fence and a beautiful garden. I got the beautiful garden, but I got no picket fence. Yeah.
By 22, she'd already had four kids. One day, three women came to her house, knocked on the door and took her children away.
Describe that day.
That day was terrible. It was the most terrible day I've ever had.
Why did they take your kids away from you?
She reckons I was an unfit mother.
Later, Cheryl cries with shame. She feels like a failed mother. The last time she called her children, they told her they thought she was dead.
Well, it's one of those things she would just like to hide under a rock, and that's what I did.
She's in her 60s now, so this happened over three decades ago, but I can tell her past is shackled to her present. The situation with her kids isn't the reason Cheryl ended up here, though. I get the sense that she was running from something, but she's not ready to tell me what. Not yet, anyway. Right now, she's more interested in getting out of here.
If it's been so bad for the last 15 years, why have you stayed?
Well, I've been trying to get out of here, but no one will have me.
I agree to drive Cheryl to her next property viewing, in Guildford, later in the week. All right, you can hop in the front. I'll just prop this in the back. So you excited about today?
Oh, I am. It's a three-bedroom, beautiful home. It'd have to be beautiful for the bride. Yeah. 300, what's wrong with it?
The feeling in the car's light, but suddenly Cheryl's mood darkens.
After I leave the caravan park, I'm not telling nobody where I'm going. I'm going to change my name, everything.
She mumbles something about hiding. We're weaving through roundabouts now, and there's nowhere to pull up, so we just keep talking as I drive.
What is the thing that you're hiding?
No, nothing bad. It's what happened to me, and I can't say, because it's not nice, really and truly.
She starts talking about an ex-partner.
He raped me every day, and when I didn't do what he was told to do, he'd burn me with cigarette. Burn me until I would scream out there, and no one would come running.
It's okay, Cheryl. It's okay.
Well, it's not really, because it's very, it's very painful, and I still got the scars. He punched me in the face and then put my head through the glass door, of front door. Oh, he was a vicious mongrel.
Cheryl says after that incident, she was at the doctor when she realised she needed to find a secret place to hole up.
I said, what am I supposed to do? I've got to go hide.
She says by the time that she'd found the caravan park and the police investigation began, the man that she was running from took his own life, but she's never shaken the fear.
Yes, I watch my back and, you know, no one really knows where I am.
Our conversation is cut short as we approach the property.
Number 626, yeah?
Yeah, 626.
All right.
Go slow.
We'll drive in here.
Yeah.
Cheryl quickly composes herself and wipes away the tears.
Well, I hope it's a good one for you. Mm. A bit early, but...
That's all right.
Yeah.
We can have a sticky beak.
Needs
at the viewing, she's picky and meticulous, inspecting every little detail.
Yeah. The clothesline's not at my standards. Clothesline, no. Needs a lot of work. I mean, it's okay. This needs fixing.
This place is about the same rent as Cheryl's small caravan. And as she rifles through the cupboards, I think back to our conversations in the car. I know Cheryl desperately wants to get out of the park, but I wonder if she's tied to it more than she realises. It's the hiding place that she needed, maybe still needs. And now she's worried about those rumours of men in suits walking through the park carrying folders who want to turn the park into apartments. Remember that family drawing Godzilla destroying a town? I'm walking to their caravan now. It's just lightly pouring with rain, but it actually looks quite beautiful. There's a street light that's just casting a bit of a reflection onto the street. And there's little mini kind of rivers going through. And to be honest, it's not what you would think. Hey Jen, how are you going?
Good, how are you?
Good. Had my first night in the caravan park.
How was it? Which side are you on?
I'm on caravan 61.
No.
You know they call you guys the North Shore.
I heard. I don't know why.
Because you guys are the fancy caravans over here. I settle in. Jen makes a cup of tea and then sits down to play Roblox on an iPad with her son Marvin. He's smooshed up against his dad, who's watching rugby on the TV. Jen's always got her hair up in a messy bun. She's someone with, like, no time to waste getting ready. Starting at 6 a.m, she works 8 hours, 6 days a week as a forklift driver in a warehouse an hour away from the park. This is a single-income household, and they pay $380 rent a week. Her partner Anthony hasn't worked in 6 years. He's a stay-at-home dad who retired early with health problems. Jen's got a youthful face. She's charming and easy to laugh with. She considers my questions carefully, but when she answers, it's direct. As she talks, I notice a trail of tattooed stars running from her ear to her neck. I can tell it's the simple moments like this one at home in the caravan that make the grind worth it.
Ow! Dad keeps annoying me when I
just died. What happened?
The car hit you, that's why you're not listening.
Well, I don't know how to play this game.
You're on the road again. Get off the road.
They used to live in a much more spacious two-story townhouse in St. Mary's, but they were evicted when Jen was between jobs and Centrelink wasn't moving fast enough. A work colleague told her about a hidden-away caravan park with affordable prices. The day she moved in, she felt like she'd hit rock bottom.
So when I walked in, I had no feeling of it. I had no aura from it. It was just like, ugh, gross. And then I was thinking to myself, how am I going to make this a home, you know? But I did.
Jen had to scrub bird shit off the walls from the previous owner's pets, put up new wallpaper, change the light bulbs, and hung up family photos in white frames.
I'm in the box, but people outside the box will see it differently. But it is my happy place. It is our happy place. So, yeah, it is different. It took me a long time to come to terms with it.
But her son Marvin still remembers the house he once called home.
You had a trampoline.
Yes.
You had a cubby house.
Yes.
You had a sand pit.
Yeah, because that was a sand house.
You had a sand pit.
Yes.
Jen's wondering what will happen when Marvin gets a bit older. Will he miss out when kids don't want to sleep over or come to his birthday parties because he lives in a caravan park?
I think when we left St. Mary's, that was really hard because Marvin had grown up there. That was, you know, when we left there, and he always talks about it now and again. It can make me cry. He misses it. He misses his old place because those were his memories there. He made memories there and he thinks that's his home. So you've got to start fresh. Yeah. That's teary. He always says, Mum, can we go back there? Can we go back there? But yeah. So I see, I kind of like see in the future that maybe we will have to leave here. I don't want to leave here. I'm happy here, but for him, we will have to one day. Yeah.
Being a mother, being a partner, and being able to provide for the one she loves is something Jen doesn't take for granted. A decade ago, Jen was an addict. She did armed robberies to support her heroin problem, and eventually she landed in jail. Her partner had been an addict. She was already a young mother at age 21, and she was struggling to bring up two kids. But she doesn't use any of this as an excuse for her life decisions.
In reality, we have choices. You know, we can either turn the bad way or the good way. And what happened to me is I turned to drugs, and I don't know why I turned to drugs. Maybe I was just bored with life and I had nothing. You know, I had two children to bring up. And I think maybe because I had them so young, I didn't have a life, you know, and I just thought I'd just have fun and experiment with drugs. And I did. That's how it all started. So I was doing armed robberies to support my habit, you know, I was living on the edge. You know, it was quite scary. And at that time, I'll be honest, I didn't care about the consequences. I didn't care about anything. As long as I got my hit, I was fine. I was happy. As long as I got my next hit, I was happy. But as soon as the money ran out, you do it again, and you do it again, and you do it again.
Yeah, but that moment that you've got those cuffs put on you, how did that feel for you?
Relief. Goddamn relief. I think going into custody was the best thing that's ever happened to me. The best thing, you know, even though I went into jail, people might say, you know, it's the worst place to be. But when you're in a worse place and set a mind in your own head, it's the best place to be, you know, to change your life, make amends of what you've done and take responsibility, I suppose.
It was in jail that Jen got her training as a forklift operator, her ticket to a new life outside. Holding on by a thread is something that she's used to, and she's not about to let go. Even as the city that she lives in sinks deeper into the economic paradox of rising land values and flat wages.
You know, some women would say, oh, fuck this, I can't handle this, you know, and give up. But I've got that sense of don't give up, you know, keep going, keep going. So that's what I believe.
But if this park ever disappeared, what do you think the ramifications of that could be?
Well, I hope it doesn't disappear, you know. If they took that away, if they did take this away, I'll be pretty sad because this is what happened to me. You know, like, I was in dire straits. We had nowhere to go. I didn't want to go in a hotel or a motel. It just cost too much. And this could be a last resort for many of those people who have fallen in the same situation as me.
Everyone in this park seems to be worried that one day they'll wake up to a knock on the door telling them to get out because the whole thing's been sold. So I figure it's time to talk to the people who run this place. When I first came here, I was standing in the doorway annoying you and you kept saying no.
Yeah, like, because we do like to keep the peace very much in the park and we don't want disturbances.
Andrew Drury, the park's manager, is slender, smiley and slightly nerdy.
We don't want people starting to, I don't know, come up with weird, wacky thoughts. Just we want people to be relaxed and enjoying the park and not have any anxiety. So you came and basically we were like, no, go away.
The office and the cabin that Andrew sleeps in are in a corner near the front of the park. There's CCTV screens everywhere.
I've got a screen up here, so when I'm in the bathroom or even in the shower, and even in the mirror, so I'm brushing my teeth, I can actually, it reflects onto the screen, and so I can see what's going on no matter what I'm doing.
How do you think this comes across?
Maybe I shouldn't be saying all this stuff.
On the screens, Andrew can pick out every one of the park's 120 residents by their shape, the way they walk, and the cars they drive. The one now on the screen isn't making sense.
Now, this car has just pulled up, so I'm wondering who it is that's coming out.
Okay, someone's coming in. Oh.
G'day.
How you going?
How are you?
Good.
I don't know if you're aware of it, you know, my uncle Steve, 83.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, he passed away yesterday.
Oh, really?
He hasn't really got many people.
Yeah.
So I thought I'd better come down and see what to do.
That's so sad to hear.
Yeah, I know.
What was... Because I know he had to have, like, 1,001 stents.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, he had the operation.
The guy in the doorway is a builder and wants to renovate the caravan his dead uncle owned. Andrew gives him a reality check.
Now, I've said this to a few of the owners who have wanted to do renovations and they've wanted to spend, you know, tens of thousands of dollars. And I always warn them to say, if the boss is ever just throwing a big bucket of money... in the end, he is just an investor. If the price is right, he would sell the property.
Yep.
They could get a DA through, and you would be told to go within the year.
Renters like Andrew, Cheryl, and Jen could be booted out with much less notice than a year. I've done some research. The caravan park was listed on the market for more than 3 years, right up until January last year. At one point in 2016. The price was briefly listed at $14.5 million. All these people that I've met at the park, they still seem to think it's only a matter of time before it's sold. I want to know if the owners have plans to sell it anytime soon. I'm going to call George Aroni, who's one of the owners of the caravan park. He's told me to give him a call back so we can get a clear answer on the future of the park.
Hello.
Hi, George. It's Madhul Khan from the ABC. I'm good. You don't seem too excited to hear from me. George says that the park only looked like it was up for sale for 1,200 days because of a deal that he made with a property agent that took a while to get out of.
And so we kept on playing the game because at the end of the day we had nothing to lose. We were still collecting our incomes. But in the end, we realised that he didn't have the money, so we didn't bother about it. And we've since haven't bothered with anyone else.
And it's a good income. George tells me Fairfield West Caravan Park makes more than $1 million a year. He rejected suggestions that the park was deliberately run down, saying it was worse when he bought it back in 2009, and he's made improvements since. But George is like any investor. He tells me that everything's always for sale, but only at the right price. I ask him what the chances are that it's going to be sold soon.
Well, as I said, it's going to be an exorbitant amount of money, which would be well above what anyone else would pay for us to offload. So the answer to that is probably zilch, you know, in the way it is at the moment. So, because we'll have the money then, and then we wouldn't know what to do with it. We'd be in the same boat that it is, whoever it is that's buying it.
Remember how Andrew, the park pensioner, kept at me about going to a soccer game with him?
Keep it up, Blues! Come on!
I had no idea. At Sydney Olympic Football Club, Andrew's known simply as the legend.
Hey! There's only one Olympic finally! Only one! Come on, boys!
Oh, absolute legend, you know. I mean, he's everything for the club in terms of representation and an icon, yeah. So I think that for us, we love having him around. I mean, even as a little boy, for me, I remember him. And it's great to be able to sit next to him today and still celebrate with him.
I'm in my element, you know what I mean? Yeah. I'm in the groove, sir, man.
I'm with the VIP. Here, Andrew's a hero to everyone, even team captain, Haji Gligor.
He's the epitome of the club. He's a legend. This club doesn't function without Andrea. And obviously, without Andrea, we don't have a crowd, we don't have the passion. He's a legend.
You little girl, aren't you? Hmm? Yes. Aren't you beautiful? Hmm? My baby girl.
Back at the park in her dark cabin, Cheryl and her cat are looking at the property listings scattered on her coffee table.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Put a finger on that one in North Parramatta. Her daily tablets hang on the wall in a plastic dispenser with a smiling sun and moon to mark which are for the night and which are for the day.
I want to get the hell out of here. I does. Yeah. My dream is to get a place for me and my cats, my plants, and live happily ever after until I die.
In the caravan next door, Jen's on her day off, spending time with her boy. She doesn't want this park, her happy place, to disappear. Marvin's beginning to realise that he lives in a caravan park, but it still feels like a place memories are being made.
You like living in a caravan? You don't mind?
Yes, I do.
You do mind?
I do mind living in the caravan park, but I do like this place.
You do like this place?
As Jen and I talk, it strikes me how much a home defines our lives.
Did you think back then that you'd have all this?
Happy? A happy life? Look, no.
I'm looking over at, you know, Marvin's little picture on the fridge right now. Just to think, you know, where you were.
People may think, like, oh, this is... What have you got to show? It's not always about what you have to show, you know. It's... I suppose when you have a child, it's about happiness, memories, you know. Just spending quality time with each other in silence is rewarding, you know, even though he's on his iPad for like, you know, half an hour or an hour and I'm on my phone, just that togetherness, and then we get off and then we do homework or we read or we talk about things, you know, those are the cherished moments. It's not about having a really nice car, fancy clothes, you know, some people want that, but to me, this is it. This is my raw life. This is maybe nothing, but to me it's everything, you know, it's everything to me.
Background Briefing sound producers are Lila Schunner and Ingrid Wagner. Sound engineering by Anne-Marie de Bettencourt. Fact-checking by Benjamin Sveen. Jeff Thompson is the producer. The supervising producer is Tim Roxburgh. And our executive producer is Alice Brennan. I'm Radula Amin. If this story has raised any issues for you, you can call Lifeline on 131114 or 1-800-RESPECT. They're a domestic and family violence counselling service ready to take your calls 24/7. That number is 1800 737 732. You can subscribe to Background Briefing for free wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.
And after that story was first broadcast, a fundraiser was held for Andrew, and it brought in $50,000 in donations that allowed Andrew to pay for eye surgery. But Andrew told Background Briefing that he gave most of it away to charities, including a breast cancer foundation in memory of his late wife. Andrew continues to work and save so that one day he can move out with his young son. In a moment, we'll meet extreme conservationist Joel Berger. Our next guest studies life at the edges of the world. He observes the extraordinary creatures which inhabit some of the world's most extreme environments. And it's a job that, I suppose, actually makes him an extraordinary creature who inhabits some of the world's most extreme environments too. Professor Joel Berger is a senior scientist for the Wildlife Conservation Society and the Barbara Cox Anthony Chair in Wildlife Conservation at Colorado State University. In Joel's own words, as a wildlife conservation biologist studying climate change, I want to understand the evolving environment through the eyes of large animals. My work in cold, remote places involves finding animals and ways to eat, sleep, and be warm. I might be miserable, but I get insights that others cannot into what animals are doing. For Joel Berger, that could mean dressing up as a polar bear or a grizzly bear or a caribou as well, in order to approach and closely observe other animals. Our own Tim Flannery has described Joel as a hero of biology who deserves the highest honours that science can bestow. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Professor Joel Berger. G'day, Joel.
Hey, Julian. It's great to be talking with you and certainly to your audience. I haven't been back to Australia since a sabbatical in the 1990s, and so I really need to come back.
Well, we'd love to have you, and hopefully the travel restrictions will allow that at some point. But let's talk about a very different environment from Australia, Joel, because a lot of your work has focused on these extraordinary creatures, the musk oxen. Could you tell us how and why you became interested in musk oxen?
Yeah, so musk oxen are, and certainly people can look it up if they don't know, but they're very large, about 300-kilogram animals that live exclusively in the Arctic. They've got long furry hair. They used to roam with woolly mammoths. Mammoths went extinct. Musk ox did not. But my path to get to musk ox was not direct. I was studying rhinos and the dehorning of rhinos in the Namib Desert in Namibia. And after that project abruptly ended, I asked myself, well, where else are there some mammals that we would be interested in learning about? And yet many people haven't kind of cracked that noggin to figure out how best to do that. And so that was the major reason that I got interested in muskox. And of course, climate change was breathing down the necks of all cold adapted species.
Can you give us a sense, Joel, of the environments that you need to go to and stay in to be able to observe musk oxen and what some of the other challenges of observing these amazing animals is?
So most of my work is in the late winter, and that's because we can get around on snow machines. And so it's Arctic, so it's tundra. There are mountains, there are canyons. It's pretty rocky. There are coastlines. There are very few to no people. Sometimes it's 150 kilometers between villages, and you don't just get in a car and go at 100 kilometers an hour. It's slow going on a snow machine. So it's cold and it's windy and it's snowy. And I work with a local fellow who's a Nupiat, who's been there for, or his kin have been there for about 10,000 years. So he knows the area very well, and he and I worked together for about 10 years. And so we go out and we look for animals, and some animals wear radio collars, and so I can get reports from the air, or we can radio track them. So those are little collars that go beep, 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 and we can pick them up. And we need to find places to stay warm in the evening because it's not a very friendly environment. It's pretty cold.
You've studied the way musk oxen react when they might come across a predator. Why did you become interested in that? And what sort of behavior did you observe?
So I think as most people actually believe that climate change is occurring, certainly in the Arctic, the people who live there are very well aware of it. And so one of the things that seems to be occurring is that there are more and more polar bears on land, particularly on an island in Russia where I used to work called Wrangel Island. It's northeast of Siberia. And because the sea ice is melting, polar bears don't have access to the ice as much as they used to. So they're concentrating on land. Now, we do know that polar bears can prey on caribou. They have successfully in the Norwegian, Russian Arctic. And there are cases of polar bears both attempting and being successful at preying on muskox. And so I needed to figure out, can muskox figure out that polar bears are dangerous? And it seems silly to think, oh, well, maybe they don't. But if they don't, they're going to be toast. And so part of the studies that my colleagues and I are involved in is trying to understand how muskox will respond to polar bears. And we could easily sit out for months in the winter and maybe see two or three interactions, and that'd be pretty miserable for us and not very rewarding. And, you know, the hallmark of being a scientist is you do experiments. And so we started to experiment, and we do this work also in Alaska. So we work in the Alaskan Arctic and the Russian Arctic. Dress up as a polar bear, dress up as a grizzly bear. And we all know that, hey, maybe the muskox are just responding to idiots that are humans that are in these costumes. So, and so it's like, all right, well, we need one more because, as I said, the hallmark of being a scientist is you need to do an experiment. So we dressed up as a caribou. And the presumption is, well, if muskox figure this out, they know caribou are not going to eat them because they graze, they eat lichens, and maybe bears will eat them. So we wanted to know if there was a difference. And Julian, I'm going to take a deep breath because I've been talking more than I normally do.
No worries at all. Look, I'm glad to hear it. First, I thought it might have been just sort of wildlife conservationist cosplay that you were involved in, but it was all in the name of science. And what did you discover by dressing up as these different animals, Joel? And also, how dangerous is it to be that close, whether you're disguised or not?
So what we discovered is this, that musk oxen in Russia figured out that polar bears can't chase them very far. We don't know why the polar bears can't chase very far. They can run up to 40 or more kilometers an hour. Maybe they overheat, but we don't know if that's true. But we do know that the musk ox keep going and going. On the other hand, in Alaska, where we do the same studies, musk ox are much less likely to run from grizzly bears. And we presume the reason for this is that when we scour the scientific literature for witness observations, grizzly bears can also run 40 kilometers an hour, sometimes 50, and sometimes they can chase their prey for 3 or 4 kilometers.
Amazing. And I suppose that just leads to the question, Joel, of your own personal safety when you're in this environment. Now, I know you're dressing up as the potential predator, but these musk oxen are very large creatures. How do they react to you when you're there just appearing as good old Joel, or when you're dressed up as different animals?
So, yeah, there's trepidation. My heart rate increases. I have been charged. We've done about 120 of these playbacks. And so 120 different encounters we've provoked by going in close on all fours. When I say we, I mean me. And 7 times I've been charged. three times, or maybe it was four, were serious charges, and the other were just the animal would leave the group and come at me. But my escape strategy, and because nobody's ever done this before, nobody had any good suggestions. And so in somewhat of a freaky way, I threw off the cape, which surrounds me. It's white because it's a polar bear cape. And I popped the head off and tossed the head up in the air. And instead of being on all fours, I stand upright. And so far, each time, well, I'm still here and I'm talking to Julia.
Well, that's an immense relief. And the mental image of a sort of disguised polar bear revealing itself to be a human and throwing the polar bear head up in the air is enough to astound me. So I can believe that it would astound musk oxen as well. That's amazing. And there is an incredible photograph of you doing exactly that as well, which I highly recommend to listeners. Now, Joel, the risks that you take when you undertake this work in extreme environments aren't just from the animals as well. I gather you've had a few encounters with the authorities too, and that's actually got you banned from some areas of research. Is that right?
The rhino research ended because they did not like our results. The government did not, and they were advocating a policy of foreign trade. And I had no stake in the management outcomes. And, you know, our results are published in top-of-the-line peer-reviewed journals. And so it was a scientific skirmish. But, yeah, I could no longer go back to Namibia to do research. But in this case in Russia, I was arrested for a date error on my permit. And it was the Russian Scientific Commission that actually had booked this for me. But as a consequence, when we landed in this small town in Siberia called Pivik, but security forces took me off the plane, booked me. I was interned, had to wait a few days, went to court. I wasn't totally sure what the interpreters were saying, but one of the interpreters said, just sign here, it's okay. So I took a gamble and I signed it. Hands were slapped, not literally, and I was told I could not return for at least 3 years. And so I haven't been back.
What has been the impact of that ban? I gather it's forced you to focus your studies elsewhere in Chile, is that right?
Yeah, so I've picked the most endangered terrestrial mammal that we know of in the Western Hemisphere. It's called a huemul, H-U-E-M-U-L, and it lives in the shadow of the Andes ice domes, the Patagonia ice domes, I should say. It's also Chile's national mammal. There are a lot of people who are excited about the plight of huemul, and the Chilean government is super supportive of trying to, you know, do more for conservation and for science.
I can almost hear the keyboards typing now to Google the huemul, Joel. But for those who haven't quite got to the image search yet, could you describe what a huemul is like?
So a huemul looks like a fat, chunky deer. It's way more spectacular than that, but that's kind of what it looks like.
Amazing. Well, Professor Joel Berger, it's been absolutely great speaking with you and hearing about your ever-expanding array of extraordinary animal costumes to do your work. Thank you so much for joining us on Sunday Extra.
Hey, Julian, thanks again so much. Hope to see you in person one day.
And Professor Joel Berger is the Barbara Cox Anthony Chair of Wildlife Conservation at Colorado State University. And his most recently published book is Extreme Conservation. And Joel spoke with me on Sunday Extra in October. I'm Julian Morrow. Thanks for listening.